What do Hosea, or some would pronounce it Hosea, which is probably more correct, but I think most of us say Hosea. What do Hosea, Obadiah, and Micah have in common? They are writing prophets as opposed to the oral prophets like Elijah and Elisha. Can we get some adult supervision up in this section, please? Three of the minor prophets. Why do we call them minor prophets? Because they were short? Oh, the books are shorter, not the men. They didn't weigh in for us. Shorter books, as opposed to Isaiah or Jeremiah that have lots of chapters. These are a bit shorter, although Hosea is the longer one of the books. Besides the fact that they're minor prophets, and besides the fact that the minor prophets, by and large, have some common themes that run throughout them, that's almost about all that these three prophets have in common. They prophesy, the three of them, in different directions. Hosea and Micah are sort of contemporaneous. They sort of prophesy at the same time, but they're prophesying in two different places. When you come to study the prophets, and let me just stop and talk in general terms here. When you come to study the prophets, whether it be major prophets or minor prophets, any of the 16 prophets that in the Old Testament, there are some things that you need to ask, some things you need to try to figure out in order to better understand and better appreciate what's being said in the book. And I've talked about this in the young adult class that I'm teaching Sunday mornings, but I don't know if we've talked about that in here. And you probably have in other classes. One question you need to ask when you study the prophets, major prophets or minor prophets, is are they prophesying to the northern kingdom or the southern kingdom? You need to figure that out. Because the prophets, all of the prophets are prophesying during the period of the divided kingdom. You know that after Solomon died, that there was a battle, there was a fight for the throne, and that it was divided, and you had 10 tribes go to the north in Israel, 2 tribes in the south in Judah. And all of the prophets, major and minor, are writing during that period of the divided kingdom. So when you study a prophet, Hosea, Obadiah, or Micah, ask who are they talking to? Are they talking to the northern kingdom, or are they talking to the southern kingdom? Why is that important? Well, the northern kingdom never had a single righteous king. They were a wicked, evil people, led by wicked, evil kings, and that kind of trickled down to the people. And so when you're reading a prophet to the northern kingdom, here's people that don't have a whole lot of hope. When we studied, what were the prophets we studied on Sunday? I can't even remember now who the prophets were that we studied Sunday. Anybody remember? I don't remember. Yeah, that was it. I knew there was a reason I couldn't remember his name. He didn't have a name. In 1 Kings chapter 13, God sent the young prophet from Judah to go up to Bethel, which is in the northern kingdom, to prophesy. Well, why didn't he send somebody from the northern kingdom? It's possible that there was no faithful prophet to send. So here's, you need to decide, who are they prophesying to, northern kingdom or southern kingdom? The northern kingdom fell to the Assyrians in about 721 B.C. The southern kingdom fell to Babylon in about 586 B.C. So the southern kingdom, with its few righteous kings, lasted about 135 years longer than the northern kingdom did. Now, second question you need to ask. Who are they prophesied to is the first question. Second question is, when did they prophesy? About when? Not, you don't have to get down to the very year, but about when did they prophesy? And that's basically divided into three periods. One would be described as the pre-exilic or the pre-captivity prophets. Those who prophesied to the northern kingdom or southern kingdom before they were taken away into captivity. Well, if I'm a prophet and I'm talking to people about things they need to do and they haven't been taken into captivity yet, those prophecies are going to be a bit different than others. If it's pre-exilic, if it's before they're going into captivity, I'm going to be warning them. That's what the prophets in the pre-exilic period did. I'm going to be warning them, saying, hey, you're not going down the right path. You need to come back, because if you don't come back, you're going to go into captivity. So there was very much a warning on that end. Then the second period, we're never going to get to these three books, are we? The second period are the exilic prophets, or those who prophesy during the captivity. Men like Daniel, men like Jeremiah kind of straddles on both sides of that, where there are men who prophesy to God's people while they're in captivity. Well, what would you be saying to people who are in captivity? Would it still be warning them and telling them to come back? You got to get back, or no, they're already in captivity. So now what are you going to be? What are they going to be telling them something different now? There's hope. Don't get lost in the fact that you're a prisoner. There is hope. God is going to bring you out. And so Jeremiah is the one who said it's going to be 70 years and that's it. So it's a question. It's a focus on hope in those. Then the third period are those post-exilic after the captivity, or the restoration prophets, who prophesied after God's people have come out of captivity. They've come back to the promised land, and now they are re-inhabiting. You read about Malachi, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, the last three of the minor prophets. Well, is that a warning? Is that like pre-exilic warning? Got to come back or you're going to go into captivity. Well, not so much. Is it a matter of hope? Well, not the same as the exilic prophets were. If they've come back now to the promised land again and they're re-inhabiting, you don't even have to know Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, but what would you think that they would say? What do you think God would say to them? What do you think God would say to a group of people that are now coming back to the promised land? Well, he's going to say, don't do what they did before. Learn from the past. Let's not go down that path again. So there may be some warnings about let's not play that tune again. They're coming back to the promised land. When they got back, while they were gone, had everybody cleaned up the house? You know, while they were gone over in Babylon, everybody that was left there, did they clean up, you know, the place and rebuild all the walls and make it nice and tidy so that when God's people got back, they could just move right in and be comfortable? Or was there work to do? Oh, yeah, they didn't like that. So they come back and there's work to do. And they start doing the work, and then they get discouraged. And the inhabitants are saying, hey, you, stop building that. You don't, you know, and so all of that. Anyway, so Haggai has to come in and say, hello, let's consider your ways and get back on the road here. So anyway, three different periods of the prophets. So who do they prophesy to, northern or southern? When did they prophesy? Three different periods. And then the third question, I won't develop this, but what was happening? What were the political movements that were happening? What was the religious situation like? What was the background and what was happening in those days? Okay, so those are kind of some background things we need to talk about. Let's get to these books. Book of Hosea. What do we know about the Book of Hosea? Book of Hosea is one of the more striking books of the Old Testament. You might read the book of Song of Solomon in the Old Testament and think that's one of the most striking books that, wow, that's in the Bible? Okay. And see some very vivid things talked about in the book of Song of Solomon. When you read the book of Hosea, it's in a different line, but it's still a wow factor that's involved in reading this book. Hosea's name means God is salvation. There was a king whose name was Hoshea, just put an H in there, spelled almost the same way. There was a leader of God's people named Jeshua, or Joshua, same root word. Joshua delivered the people into the promised land. He was the deliverer. He was the savior. Joshua brought them in, same root word. In the New Testament, there was another deliverer. There was another savior in the New Testament who had the same root word as Hoshea and Hosea and Jeshua. You know what his name was in the New Testament?
Jesus.
Same root word. His name, he shall be called Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. That's because that's what Jesus meant. And that's what Joshua, Hosea meant. God is salvation. Hosea prophesies to the northern kingdom of Israel. Remember, we're trying to figure out who they're talking to. wicked nation because they had no righteous king. He prophesied in the 8th century B.C., sometime probably between 745 to 715 or 725 B.C., somewhere in that 20 to 30 year period, is when Hosea prophesied. Well, if he's prophesying to the northern kingdom about this time, remember that the northern kingdom fell to Assyria in 721 B.C. So if he's prophesying to them right before they're about ready to be taken into captivity, what do you think he's saying? Pack your bags. You know, make sure you pack all your niceties and pack all of your unmentionables. Get all of those ready because what do you think he said to them? You think you're going to find some strong words from Hosea to these people? Now, why were they going into captivity? Was this just like a 70-year vacation? New scenery? You know, let some people come clean up Jerusalem and we'll go somewhere else? Why are they going into captivity? What's the deal with God's people? Why are they going to be captured? They hadn't had a good king. What'd you say, Tommy? They've been disobedient to God. When Assyria, world power Assyria, were they righteous? Were they doing everything that God, were they obedient to God? So you're saying a wicked nation comes and destroys and takes captive God's people. Is that what happened? Well, why would God allow some wicked, idolatrous, pagan nation to come and overpower and destroy his nation? That doesn't seem fair. Why would God allow that to happen? As punishment. Same thing that happened in the period of the judges. Now, so does that mean that God liked Assyria more than God liked his own people? So does that mean God's going to let Assyria off the hook for their badness because he used them? Guess what happened to Assyria? They were destroyed. Why? Same reason that Israel was. Not a different reason. The same reason. They're disobedient to God. An idolatrous nation that's not serving God. Okay, so here's Hosea. Let me give you three major points, major things taught in the book of Hosea, because we really only have time for one, but I couldn't stop at one. So here's three major things that you learn in the book of Hosea. And if you have to sum it up in one phrase, you're talking about a loving God. And you're talking about an adulterous, I almost said idolatrous, and it would have been the same thing, adulterous people. And for each of these three books, I'm going to give you those two contrasts. Here's a loving God, but he's dealing with an adulterous people. Get the book of Hosea out, and let's look at a couple of these verses about the idolatry. Can you believe that God's people were worshiping idols? I mean, we're not talking about somebody who hadn't... Then we're talking about God's people. Go to chapter 2, Hosea chapter 2, verse 13. I will punish her for the days of the Baals to which she burned incense. Who's the Baals? Who's Baal? This is great God, this great idol that the Canaanites had served, along with several others. And what are they doing to this idol? They are burning incense. Go to chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 12. My people ask counsel from their wooden idols. Huh? How dumb do you have to be to walk up to a wooden idol and ask for advice? What do you think I should do in this situation? Well, you're probably going to hear what you want to hear, right? I mean, if you're not all there to be talking to an idol asking for counsel, he's probably going to say what you want him to say, right? Don't you figure? Look at verse 13. They offered sacrifices on the mountaintops, and they burned incense on the hills under the oaks, the poplars, and the terebinth trees. Look in chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 4. They set up kings, but not by me. These weren't my kings. Verse 5, or the end of verse 4. From their silver and gold, they made idols for themselves. They're not serving God. They've taken their precious possessions, precious metals, and they've made gods. Go over to chapter 13. We'll skip that one on chapter 10. Look in chapter 13. When Ephraim spoke, and by the way, I had this on the first screen, and maybe I should go back and point this out. When you read, especially the book of Hosea, and you read about Ephraim, this confused me forever as a kid. Because I can never figure out as a kid, why does he keep talking about Samaria, and then he talks about Ephraim, and then he talks about, who are these people? Are these different people? And as a kid, when all of these different words are used, you're like, who is he talking about? Well, Israel is the northern kingdom. Their capital city is Samaria. So when you read the prophets, sometimes it's talking about judgment coming upon Samaria. Well, it's not just the city of Samaria. It'd be talking about the whole nation, but they would just use the word Samaria, that city, to represent the whole nation. And especially in the book of Hosea, he calls the northern kingdom Ephraim throughout the book. He calls it, that's the dominant word that he uses for the northern kingdom. But he's just talking about Israel. And that confused me as a kid, probably because we had Ephraim Davis here as a member. And I was thinking, what did Ephraim ever do to God that made God mad? I always thought that Ephraim Davis was a cake not turned. I thought, that doesn't make sense, but that's what Hosea said. So here's Ephraim. Just a word that's used frequently to talk about the northern kingdom. When Ephraim spoke trembling, he exalted himself in Israel. And when he offended through Baal worship, he died. Now they sin more and more, and have made for themselves molded images, idols of their silver, according to their skill. Oh, they're so good at making these. All of it is the work of craftsmen. They say to them, let the men who sacrifice kiss the calves. We're going to worship these idols. We're going to bow down to these idols. Kiss the ground in the direction of, we will even kiss these calves. Can you believe that God's people were doing this? Well, is God just going to sit by and let that happen? You've got two entire chapters, chapter 6 and chapter 14 of this book, where God is pleading with them to repent. Remember when this is written? It's written right before the northern kingdom is taken into captivity. And God has not yet just cast them off and said, too bad. God is still begging them to return. Now, here's what's so startling about this book, is that when God looks at the sin of Israel in the book of Hosea, when God looks at the sin of Israel, God refers to their sin 16 times or 18 times in this book. God refers to their sin either using the word adultery or harlotry or whoredom to talk about their sin. Could you find a word that would be more graphic and would be more vivid than to say, Israel, what you're doing is you're committing whoredom? You think that'd be very popular today? Suppose I can't, you probably can't imagine this, but just suppose that a political person called another political person a whore. Surely that would never happen in our society, right? So would that be kindly accepted in our society? No, that's not a very nice thing to say. God says to Israel, you are committing whoredom. What were they doing? Was it physical, sexual adultery that God was talking about? Well, that was probably involved, but that's not the emphasis of it. When they were worshiping these idols, when they are bowing down and kissing Baal, when they are burning incense to Baal, when they are offering sacrifices to Baal, wait a minute. If I'm a Jew, Deuteronomy chapter 5 says that if I'm a Jew, that God made a covenant with me. Hello. God made a covenant with... Well, what's that all about? God made an agreement, a binding agreement. He made a covenant with me. God is married to me. I'm married to God. How many gods are there? Oh, there's just one and I'm married to that one God. But if I turn my back on that one God, and instead of worshiping and serving that one God, I go and worship another God. I go and worship an idol. What have I just done? Have I cheated on God? Am I having an affair against God? Am I sleeping around? What am I doing? God doesn't use any of these, you know, words that we have created to kind of soften the blow. He doesn't say, "Oh, you're having relations with another God," and he doesn't say, "Oh, you're having an affair." No, God says you're committing whoredom by turning to these other gods. You're committing adultery, Trudy. You're committing spiritual adultery. When there's only one God and you turn your back on that one God, where else can you go? I wish we had time to look at this story, but I hope you know the story about Hosea and his wife Gomer. And if you don't, go home and read the first three chapters of the book of Hosea. Incredible story where God commands Hosea to go and to marry this woman of harlotry. Marries Gomer. They have three children. Go home and read about their children. And each of the names of their children that were given to them signified how God's people were stepping away from God. You're no longer my people. You no longer receive my mercy. That's the names of their kids. You're not mine anymore. You have taken these steps down the way and you don't belong to me. You've turned your back on me. You are committing harlotry and whoredom against me. And we don't know all of the details that are involved in this, but it appears that Gomer, Hosea's wife, had so far gone down herself the road of harlotry, being a prostitute, that she had left Hosea. What was the punishment? Under Jewish law, what's the punishment for adultery? Death. What did she deserve? To die a lot for what she had done. But one would be enough times, right? What does God tell Hosea to do in chapter 3? Go, get her, and love her again. And he pays what is believed to be the price of a slave in order to get his wife back. No, 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 no. If she's done that, if she's gone all the way, just let her go. Why do you want her back? I mean, she has done all of that with all of those. No, 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 no. If she's done all of that with all of those other people, just let her go. You know, let her go down that path and don't bring her back. Mm-mm. God says, you go and you get her back. You bring her home and you love her again. What's the point? The whole point of those first three chapters about the relationship between Hosea and Gomer is that is the exact relationship that God had with Israel. God went and married Israel. And what did Israel do? Israel went and had kids with other gods. To the point that they're running down this road and turning their back on God and worshiping these other gods and these idols. Why didn't God just wipe them off the face of the earth? Well, forget you. I'll just go get somebody else if that's the way you're going to treat me. God was willing to even go into the home of the prostitutes to get his people back if they would come. What does this book teach about the love of God? It frustrates me when people say that the God of the Old Testament is different than the God of the New Testament. The Old Testament, you read about a vengeful, you know, mean and angry God who killed people all the time. And in the New Testament, you read about a nice and loving and caring God who would never do anything bad to anybody ever. How about this book? How about this book where God is begging his people to come back? Where at least six times in these chapters, God uses a Hebrew expression that describes the loving, merciful kindness that he has for his people. And he wants, he is a loving husband who's not going to give up on his unfaithful wife, no matter what she has done, until the time comes where the justice of God must be paid. This is an incredible book about a loving God and an idolatrous and adulterous people. You know, sometimes when you love somebody, do you ever have to tell them what they're doing wrong? Do you have to ever have to point out their sins? If you love me, you won't tell me that kind of thing. If you love me, you won't bring those things to my attention. No, he loved them and said, here's what you're doing wrong. And he told them how to get right, and he begged them to get it right. But they wouldn't do it. Wow, we've got 12 minutes to talk about two more books. Think we're going to do it? Well, Obadiah, it's a short book. We ought to be able to get through this one kind of quick, right? Doubt that. Okay, so here's Obadiah. Obadiah, we don't know when Obadiah wrote. Here was Hosea, northern kingdom, somewhere about the same time that Micah and Isaiah were in the southern kingdom. Hosea's in the northern kingdom before the Israel fell, and we know that. Here's Obadiah, we don't know when he wrote. He doesn't give us any time markers or kings or anything that we can pinpoint in his writings. And so it has been suggested anywhere from about 850 B.C. all the way down to about 312 B.C., about a 500-year period that he could have wrote anywhere in there. Seems most likely that it was either about 850 B.C. or maybe even more likely somewhere around 850 or 586 B.C. Or shortly thereafter. Because when he writes, when Obadiah writes, there's been some significant calamity that Jerusalem has experienced. And of course, we think significant calamity. We think, well, that's when Babylon came in and destroyed them in 586, and that's true. But there were several significant calamities that Jerusalem experienced, and we can't, with complete accuracy, pinpoint which one it is. Perhaps that's the most realistic. But anyway, the time is not that significant. The point of the book is obvious, that he is prophesying the impending doom of the Edomites. Who are the Edomites? Are they like the people that go around eating people? And so they were called the Edomites because they were eating them up. Who are the Edomites? Sorry, that was bad, but I wanted you to think about that. The descendants of Esau. So if there was problems between Israel and Edom, how far back does that go? Israel. Where do we first read the name Israel? Somebody's name was changed to Israel. Whose name was changed to Israel? Jacob. Whose brother was Jacob? Esau. Who are the descendants of Esau? The Edomites. Did Jacob and Esau, if you go all the way back, two brothers, twin brothers, did they get along good? No. From the get-go, they didn't get along so good, did they? Go and read about their birth in Genesis 25. They had problems from the very beginning. And you go down through their history, and here's Israel in Numbers 20 trying to come up the eastern side of the Dead Sea and go to the Promised Land. And God said, leave Edom alone. Don't hurt them. You know, just pass through peacefully. But Edom wouldn't even let them through. A lot of strife in between these two peoples. But in this book, especially verses 10 and 11, I don't know if I have that up there, but especially about verses 10 and 11, God calls Israel the brother of Edom, or calls Edom Israel's brother, back and forth. That they're referred to each other as brother Jacob. Well, because Jacob and Esau were brothers, so in effect, the Israelites and the Edomites, they're related to each other. So, if you're related to each other, shouldn't you be nice to each other? I said shouldn't. I didn't say would you. But shouldn't you be nice to each other? Yeah. So here's a calamity that is coming upon, some kind of calamity that's coming upon Jerusalem, upon God's people. The Edomites were just east of Israel, were the Edomites. And when they saw this calamity coming upon Israel, well, if something bad's going to happen to your brother, shouldn't you step up and do something about it? Not saying did you. I said, shouldn't you step up and do something about it? You should. Should you, if you see something bad coming upon your brother, should you join in with the bad thing that's about ready to happen to him and join forces and be a part of the bad thing that's about ready? I'm not saying did you. Should you join in and take part in the great, horrible thing that's going to happen? No, you shouldn't do that. So when you read the book of Obadiah, and when God talks about the judgment that is coming upon the Edomites, it is because they had joined forces with God's enemy and they had mistreated their own brethren. Very quickly, there's basically two separate parts to the book of Obadiah. And let me just throw these up here because we're just going to flat not have time for them. If you want to see a summation of the book, you have a compassionate God and you have a very prideful people in the Edomites. The Edom was, again, on the east side of the Dead Sea, basically, is if you want to know where it was. But they lived up on a cliff. They lived in the mountains. And they believed that their city was impregnable, was impervious, could not be taken, because it was on the side of a cliff about 700 feet up in the air. So who's going to scale a cliff to come and take them? So you're protected on that side. But they're also in basically what are some like caves. And so you can't get to them. Even to get to them is a narrow passage. And so you can't just take them by force. You have to go through a narrow passage. Well, if all they have to do is defend that narrow passage, that's not that hard. So they thought that they were unconquerable. We're in a good location. Nobody can take us. Besides the fact that they were just full in their own heads of their own wisdom. Nothing bad can happen to us. What does the book of Proverbs say about pride? Pride goes before fall, destruction, and a haughty spirit too. And that's exactly what happened to Edom. Edom fell because they did not protect God's people, and that they arrogantly had turned their backs and even helped out to bring destruction to God's people. So they were going to be destroyed. But God, in this same book, tells Israel that there's a better day coming for them. And I want to get to the book of Micah, so let me just say this as a closing on the book of Obadiah. When you read the book of Obadiah, it's mostly about the doom and the destruction of Edom. And so the initial thought would probably be, well, Obadiah was a prophet to Edom, like Jonah. Jonah was a prophet to Nineveh, not God's people, to a pagan city. Jonah was a prophet to Nineveh. Well, if Obadiah is prophesying about Edom, is he a prophet to Edom? No, he's not a prophet to Edom, because there's no hope. Edom's destroyed. God's not calling them back. He's not wishing them back. Their doom is already set. So why is he writing the book then? He's writing the book to tell God's people. Remember that? Remember those brethren? Remember those people who turned their back on you? Remember those people who harmed you? Guess what? They're going to be destroyed. And you are going to have peace, and you are going to be freed from them. And so it seems to be written more for the benefit of God's people that they were going to be brought out of captivity. All right, real quick, what do we have? 3 minutes for the book of Micah. That's not going to happen. 3 minutes on the book of Micah. Okay, Hosea, prophet to the northern kingdom, okay? Nation that needed a lot of help. Micah, prophet to the southern kingdom, about the same time that Isaiah is. When you think major and minor prophets, don't think, well, major wrote first, because they're first in the Bible, and then the minor prophets wrote later. No, they're all prophets, and they're all lumped together. And so Isaiah and Micah are about the same time. Hosea is just briefly before, and maybe contemporaneous the same time. Isaiah prophesies mostly in the city, but Micah seems to be more out in the country, more in the farmland. So he's not so much a city boy, but he he prophesies southern kingdom of Judah, and what's happening in Judah at this time is a lot of chaos. You've got a lot of prosperity in the nation. Well, that should be a good thing, right? I mean, if there's a lot of prosperity, if there's a lot of money, if there's everything's flourishing, that should be a good thing, right? If the economy's working good, then everything else should be good, right? Sometimes prosperity doesn't help you out spiritually, does it? Wasn't helping Israel either. And so religiously, they had become contaminated by these heathen influences that were around them. 2 minutes. What's it? What's Micah about? Talked about Obadiah, compassionate God, prideful people. Hosea, loving God, adulterous people. Here's Micah. Micah talks about a merciful God. And you see that a lot in Hosea too. A merciful God, but here's a corrupt people. A people that don't want to listen to what God has to say to them. 4 quick points. God's people have sinned and they're going to be punished. Look in chapter 3. You can look in chapter 1 later tonight, but look in chapter 3 about what it says about these people. Not just the people, but their rulers. Chapter 3 and verse 2. You who hate good and love evil. Is that backwards? Is there something wrong if your leaders hate good and love evil? Is that going to influence your nation? God's judgment is certain. Micah's the first prophet who prophesies judgment upon Judah. Samaria is about gone, but Judah is not yet. Boy, I can't believe we don't have time for this. Micah chapter 6 and verse 8 is the key verse. What does God require of you? Micah 6 and verse 8. God requires more than just the outward religiousness. God requires more than just going through the motions. What does God require of you? God requires that your heart be involved in what's happening too. And then there's several prophecies that are made in this book. You read about Jesus being born in Jerusalem, or in Bethlehem, sorry, in chapter 5, verse 2. You read about the coming kingdom, almost word for word with Isaiah 2, is Micah chapter 4. And then you read about God's mercy. But in Micah 6 and verse 8, who has shown you, O man, what is good? What does the Lord require of you? To do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. That's what God... If you want to boil it down, here's what God says He requires. Think about those three things. Does that describe you? It did not describe God's people at this time. And so God says, if you want to get back on the right track, here's what you need to do. Well, that was a very quick trip through three books that I would love to have about a year to spend on all of them, but too bad. All right, see you.